Elsa got dope. I gotta get it, I got to get it. My mother went away for a month long trip. Her and some friends on an ocean liner ship. She made a big mistake by leaving me home. I had to roam, so I picked up the phone. Got Ollie up to see what was going down. Told him I'd pick him up so we could drive around. Took the Dodge Dart, a 74. My mother left the yard, but I needed one more. Shahid had me covered with 100 green backs. So we left Brooklyn and we made big tracks. Drove down the belt, got on the conduit. Came to a toll and paid and went through it. Had no destination, we was on a quest. Ali laid in the back so he can get rest. Drove down the road for 2 days and a half. The sun had just risen on a dusty path. Just then a figure had caught my eye. A mirror for Sombrero who was 4 feet high. I pulled over to ask where he was at. His index finger, he tipped off his hat. El Segundo, he said, my name is Pedro. If you need directions, I'll tell you pronto. Need a civilization, some sort of reservation. He said a mile south, there's a fast food station. Thanks to you as I started the motor. Ali said,
damn, Tiff, what did you drive so far for?
Well, describe to me what the wallet looks like.
Anyway, a gas station we passed. We got gas and went on to get grub. It was a nice little pump in the middle of nowhere. Anywhere would have been better. I ordered enchiladas and I ate them. Ali had the fruit punch. When we finished, we thought for ways to get back. I had a hunch. Ali said,
pay for lunch.
So I did it. Pulled out the wallet and I saw this wicked, beautiful lady. She was a waitress there. Put the wallet down and stared and stared to put me back into reality. Here's Shahid.
Yo, Tip, man, you got what you need?
I checked for keys and started to step. What do you know? My wallet, I forget. Yo, it was a brown wallet. Had props numbers. Had my Jimmy hats. I gotta get it, man. Lord have mercy. The heat got hotter. Ali starts to curse me. I feel bad, but he makes me feel badder. Chit, chit, chatter. Car starts to scatter. Breaking on out, we was northeast bound. Jetting on down at the speed of sound. 3 days coming and three more going. We get back and there was no slack. 490 man. Madison, we're here, Shy. He said, all right, Tip, see you tomorrow. Thinking about the past week, the last week. Hands go in my pocket, I can't speak. Hop in the car and torpedo to the shack. The Shaheed, we gotta go back. When he said why, I said we gotta go. Cause I left my wallet in El Segundo. Yeah, I left my wallet in El Segundo. Left my wallet in El Segundo. Left my wallet in El Segundo. I gotta get it, I got to get it. Left my wallet in El Segundo. Left my wallet in El Segundo. Left my wallet in El Segundo. Come on, let's go. Come on, let's go. Come on, let's go.
Hello, everyone. It is April 2nd, 10:04 a.m., and you are listening to Swing Politics with Big Mitch, Mitch Saunders, for yet another rendition of what's going on in the political world electorally. What matters for elections? That's been going on in the past week, and there's been a lot of interesting stuff to talk about today. The biggest thing that we are going to discuss is RFK Jr.'s candidacy and his recent choice for running mate. Before we get started, I am going to take 1 second to get situated, and I will be right back on the air. Thanks so much. And we're back. A lot of interesting stuff to talk about today, and let's get started with the most interesting part of it all, which is RFK Jr. talk, which I haven't spoken about him on this radio show yet. I just did a piece about him on my blog. You should check it out at swingpolitics.com. And the major question that everyone seems to be asking is whether or not RFK Jr. will be a spoiler. Will he be a spoiler for Biden, or will he be a spoiler for Trump? Now, RFK Jr. is the son of Robert F. Kennedy, the beloved senator from New York, and his son, Robert F. Kennedy Jr., was an environmental activist lawyer who also pushed conspiracy theories throughout his career. He's someone that has not really been discredited in the public eye because he hasn't been in the public eye. There's no reason why he should sort of have any perception, or no voters should have any perception of him, because he's never been on the ballot. It was his father decades ago that was on the ballot. And of course, the Kennedy name is one that everyone knows, no matter how young or how old you are. You know about John F. Kennedy, and you know about Robert F. Kennedy, the two assassinations, and the both of them are beloved amongst obviously Democrats, independents alike, and some Republicans who, I guess, long for the old days of the Democratic Party, which is not really something that they even do. Not the Trump Republicans today. They don't yearn for any JFK, because the JFK administration also had LBJ as the vice president, and LBJ would end up signing into law the Voting Rights Act and the Civil Rights Act, both of which are things that many Trump supporters are still not a huge fan of. So Robert F. Kennedy Jr. has started his campaign he began in this cycle as a Democrat challenging Biden for the nomination. And from what I recall, I'm not entirely sure, but he dropped out either before Iowa or just after Iowa. Iowa being it's not Iowa anymore for the Democrats. It was I don't quite recall, but he dropped out after a very brief run for the Democratic nomination, attempting to challenge Biden. He was the first to drop out, before Dean Phillips and Marianne Williamson, and the sort of he was seen as a nothing burger, nobody, because he wasn't going to get the support that Biden was going to get. He wasn't going to get anywhere near any degree of support to challenge the sitting president. But he then changed course and decided to run an independent third party candidacy for the presidency. And this was a sort of candidacy that was under the radar. People didn't really know about it. Maybe if you were well connected and well informed in the political world, you knew that RFK Jr. was running for president, but not to really any significant degree. And that changed on actually the Super Bowl, when many of you might remember that there was a Kennedy ad taking from his uncle's campaign, or I don't remember entirely which campaign it was, whether it was his father's or his uncle's, but essentially took the ad directly and said to support Kennedy. And many voters might have been confused as to, you know, who is this Kennedy that's running, or, you know, maybe older viewers who had maybe seen the ad a while back, it was sort of just like a what's going on kind of moment with this advertisement. Because it didn't really mention anything about Robert F. Kennedy Jr. All it mentioned was things that the elder Kennedy had done or would do. So it was strange, and it was in black and white, and it was in the old-timey cartoon design, because it was literally his I think it was his uncle's ad. We found out shortly after that this ad was funded by Nicole Shanahan, a lawyer and philanthropist, multimillionaire, who bankrolled the Kennedy campaign to $4.5 million to get this ad on the airwaves during the Super Bowl. And this was almost the first day of RFK Jr.'s true candidacy for the Oval Office. Now, it just so turns out that he chose this very same person who bankrolled that ad and will end up bankrolling his campaign to be his vice president, his vice presidential nominee. This is a woman who very, very recently called in vitro fertilization one of the biggest lies being told about women's health and bashing the decades-old way of carrying a pregnancy to term, getting pregnant for many women who cannot, or for those that want to have in vitro fertilization a surrogate in that sense. So that's the vice presidential pick of the major conspiracy theorist, RFK Jr. And while we could delve into discussions for a while about his past, the major question that's on everyone's mind, beyond sort of his conspiracy theories and the fact that he's an anti-vaxxer and whatever's going on with his VP, the question in everyone's mind is, who is this going to be a spoiler for? Is this going to hurt Biden, or is this going to hurt Trump? Now, unfortunately, I can't give you an answer in this hour, because it's a question that will be answered in time and likely won't know really until Election Day. And if we do know before Election Day, then, you know, I'll talk about it on somewhere. It'll be posted either on my blog or, you know, if I continue the radio show in my future, because I'm graduating the semester. But we don't know, because there's so many unknowns about RFK Jr.'s candidacy, but also how the Biden and Trump campaigns will play his candidacy. So to start out with, sort of a major point is that, and this is something that I mentioned on the blog, a third-party candidacy will take votes away from the candidate with which there is ideological overlap. So to be specific about that, looking at the 2016 presidential election, you had Donald Trump as the Republican and Hillary Clinton as the Democrat. And then you also had a Libertarian candidate whose name was Gary Johnson. He was a former governor of New Mexico. And you had a Green Party candidate, Jill Stein, who was an activist who was the Green Party nominee in 2012. Now, the Libertarian nominee at the time in 2016, when Trump was a little bit less crazy, or at least spoke a little bit less crazy, the Libertarian nominee had a great deal of ideological policy, political overlap with the Republican, with Trump's campaign. And what tends to happen in that case is you have the right-wing a right-wing party and a further right-wing party in the Libertarian Party that siphons off votes from the Republican Party for whatever reason, whether, you know, voters that don't believe that Trump is extreme enough, didn't believe that Trump is extreme enough, or voters that just really wanted someone that was kind of, you know, an outsider, and they were on the right and they didn't love Trump, but they liked this guy and they wanted to vote for him. And in total, he got 3.6% of the popular vote. And Jill Stein, who was much more on the left, further left than Hillary Clinton, but still they had a great deal of ideological overlap, took about 1% of the total national popular vote for this this election. Could have the numbers wrong there. I believe that also might just have been Wisconsin, because that's the state that I was looking at for these numbers. But the greater point is that it's a very storied phenomenon that when you have a party that is more to the right or more to the left of one of the two major parties, that is going to receive votes from voters who would otherwise more likely, without that far right or far left option, choose the right or the left option. So third party candidates can be spoilers, but as many would claim in 2016 was the case, but they really are they're only spoilers if the circumstances essentially set them up to be. So in 1992, when there was sort of the high watermark of the third parties with Ross Perot, who ran in 92 and 96, in 92, Ross Perot received basically 19% of the popular vote. And Bill Clinton ended up winning the presidential election by around 5.5% in the national popular vote. And there was an article that I had read that if they were to have removed Ross Perot's candidacy, his voters would have largely, or at least greater than half, would have gone to Clinton, and Clinton would have won by a national popular vote of 7% instead of 5.5%. Ross Perot and Bill Clinton had more ideological overlap. Perot was to the left of Clinton, but they still overlapped on gun control and economic policy for the most part. So when you're talking about third-party candidates, you want to see, can this candidate sort of overlap ideologically with one side or the other? And in the case of RFK Jr., it's a little unclear. Because, weirdly enough, if you look at RFK Jr.'s website, you'll see that he has a bunch of overlap with Biden's policies on various things, environmentalism and gun control policy, but not a crazy great deal of overlap with that. But there is the immigration policies that the Biden administration have supported, the RFK Jr. Sort of agenda also supports. So it seems sort of like it's an easy answer that RFK Jr. ideologically is going to be much closer to Biden. And also, he ran as a Democrat, and he's from a party of Democrat. He's, you know, his family is Democrats, and they will always and forever be part of the Democratic Party. Though RFK Jr. is himself an independent. But this would explain the strong overlap with Biden's policies. This would explain Republican attempts to draw him like a Democrat. So when RFK Jr. was running in the primary against Biden, the Republican National Committee and the Trump campaign put out a ton of flyers and information about RFK Jr. as the reason to support him against Joe Biden, trying to draw RFK Jr. as the Democrat with which was the party that he was affiliating with at the time, and that's the party that he was running for the nomination with, in order to sort of make a cudgel against Biden and to stir up emotions against him. And now, because he has strong overlap with Biden's policies and he's running as an independent, the Republicans and Trump have flipped the script that he is the same as Biden, that he is not someone who Republicans, you know, would want to support destroying his candidacy, trying to push him and align RFK Jr. with the traditional liberal left-wing voters. At the same time, though, he's a conspiracy peddler and an anti-vaxxer, which is something that no Democrat in today's coalition would really ever vote for. And so this is the dichotomy that you're dealing with RFK Jr.'s kind of a crazy guy who attacks the Biden administration on some stuff, but they have a lot of overlap. But at the same time, he's an extremist in these few ways that make him unpalatable to a lot of the Democratic base. And actually, those things are appealing to the Republican base, because the Republican base is anti-vax and very, very pro-conspiracy in the sense of election denialism. And this is where the public perception will determine who RFK Jr. takes more votes from. This is the meat and potatoes of sort of the roundabout conversation a little bit that we've been having about RFK Jr. It will be determined by which side, whether it's Biden voters or Trump voters, have more ideological overlap and who see more of what they agree with in him. Now, there's distinct voters that are especially going to sort of be at risk for defection. So on the Republican side, it is the unengaged, non-college educated, rural Republican voter who is seeing RFK Jr. as, and they hear on the news that, you know, from Biden administration, from Biden campaign advertisements, about the extremist nature of RFK Jr., comparing him to Trump in some regard, and these voters hear about that and move to vote for him because of their nature of being uninformed, and because the Biden campaign works hard to put advertisements on the air to change the perception of what these voters in these, especially in swing states and rural areas, see as their only option in Trump. And yes, they like Trump, but maybe they like what they're hearing about this other guy. And then on the Democratic side, it'll be, again, low information voters who really largely turn out during presidential elections only, who might ride on the Kennedy name and like the Kennedy name. They're not feeling too hot on Biden, but they want sort of a change up, and they want someone who has a history of what they believe is being a leader, even though RFK Jr. has been nowhere near any leadership positions. It's riding on the Kennedy name, and that the Trump campaign and the Republicans play advertisements that make RFK Jr. Ideologically closer to Biden. They see a reasonable alternative, and they don't feel like voting for Biden again, and they want to defect. Those are the two main groups that I see as problems, that they're largely going to be low information voters. And so the question is, in both of these cases, these perceptions are going to be impacted by what they hear and what they see. What they hear and what they see is going to be on television, on social media, on news networks. That's where they're going to hear it. And so the thing that will determine, the factor that will determine how the public views him will be ad money. Who has more to invest in the airwaves? Who can flood the media markets with, yeah, sure, pro-Biden advertising and also anti-RFK Jr. advertising, but also on the other side, the pro-Trump, anti-RFK Jr. pushing him to the left. Essentially, what both advertising teams are going to be doing is they're going to be playing ping pong with the with the favorabilities almost of RFK Jr. within their own party. Which is a very funky thing because, you know, you think that you want to have more people that are on your side, but the more people that you have on your side, the more votes that you lose in terms of the more candidates that you have like on your side, essentially, because it's a plurality first past the post election system. And now, obviously, ad money and money in general has been a big topic of discussion during this campaign cycle. And this could provide the Biden camp a big opportunity to actually use RFK Jr. to take votes away from Trump and buoy their odds in swing states. And the reason why the Biden campaign has a leg up in this case is that they are sitting on a war chest that is three times the size of Trump's. And we'll get to this in a second, but Biden just had a big fundraiser in New York, which I'm sure many heard about, that raised $26 million in one night. And that's the amount that Trump raised, or more than the amount that Trump raised, in all of February. So the Biden campaign seemingly has no trouble raising money. And it's not just from big donors, too. It's from small donors. In 2020, I learned this last night, 45% of Trump's donations were small money donors. This is donors that are $200 or less donating. And it was 38% for Biden. And that is not the case anymore. We don't have the exact numbers on what the small money donors are in terms of percentage of the money raised by the campaign. But the data says that it is not the case anymore, that Trump is not, he's not really raising money, obviously, from big money donors, but not from small, from small donations either. And so the fact that Biden has so much money, and that in terms of advertising spending, right now for the presidential election, the Biden campaign has put in almost $170 million, or a bit over $170 million in advertising. And the Trump campaign has put in $2.5 million in advertising. The DNC just hired a specific team to combat third-party candidates in the election. Now, much of this, it will be sort of hard to see if a third party sort of opposition research team almost from the DNC will be effective. It's really unclear because those are campaign effects that we can't really measure. But the Biden campaign and the DNC being aligned in such a way with the money that they have to possibly, in fact, use RFK's candidacy to their benefit could prove helpful for their fight against Biden, against Trump. And now it's going to be a hard lift because the Kennedy name is inherently associated with the Democrats just because that's the way that it goes because of the history of the Kennedy family. But also because Kennedy now has a bankroll. Now he is on the payroll of Nicole Shanahan, who will give him as much money as he wants to put up whatever advertisements. It's going to be a harder thing to pull RFK Jr. down to, you know, push him off to the right with Trump. Because Kennedy likes, as Kennedy said himself, he wants to be a spoiler for Biden and Trump. He doesn't have a side that he affiliates with. Many people say that third-party candidates will always take away from the Democrats, will always take away from Biden. And that was a big case in 2020. That's why there were very few third-party candidates in 2020, and the two third-party candidates were there got a very, very small portion of the vote. It was largely a two-man race. In this election, you have Jill Stein, who's coming back again for the Green Party nomination. You have Cornel West running for whatever nomination he has. You have the Libertarian nominee, which actually the Libertarian nominee could end up being RFK Jr., which I don't suspect that he will pursue, but he has mentioned that he could do, which would definitely be a spoiler on Trump's end. But you'll probably have a separate Libertarian candidate, and then you'll have RFK Jr. And so there's also a great deal of discontent and disapproval for Joe Biden and Donald Trump being the two nominees. Now, it doesn't matter because both of those nominees are going to get more of the percentage of the popular vote than probably all of the third parties combined. But But RFK Jr. will likely get the largest share of this vote. And that 3% or whatever that he gets is going to determine the presidential election for sure. And the Biden campaign has the money to define RFK Jr. early. Keeping his name recognition low, there's some races where candidates want to keep their name recognition low because they're in hostile territory. That they want to keep things sort of below the radar, and that with the Kennedy name, people will see the Kennedy name, and that will just sort of fly for a bunch of people and say, "Oh, I didn't know a Kennedy was running. I don't really want either of these guys. I'm just going to vote for the Kennedy because I know that name and I like that name." And that could be very, very potent and dangerous among Democrats, especially Democrats who are not aware of what RFK Jr. stands for. And while there might be some policy overlap between he and Biden, he's also a loon. He's crazy in terms of pushing conspiracy theories, and is VP doing the same and anti-vaxxing. As much as he wants to state his agenda ideologically on his website, the reality of the situation is that if you're an anti-vaxxer, you probably believe in some other crazy things. And those crazy things might not be broadcast right now. But they could be if he ever got elected. So I think that there's a lot that's unknown about his candidacy, and there's a lot that will be unearthed over time through opposition research by that DNC team and by the Biden team as well. So the money that Biden has and the DNC has and the research that they're putting in is going to be very useful to almost take this candidate that could really threaten the Biden campaign and turn it against Trump. Now, the question is whether or not Trump can rival it, because right now he doesn't have the money. The Trump campaign doesn't have the money, but there's been a ton of times when we've said, how will Donald Trump get out of this one? How will he get out of this case? How will he get out of saying this thing? In this case, how will he get out of having no money? He's got friends in high places. And so the money differential right now between the Biden and the Trump campaigns, I don't think will stick. I'm very certain that the Trump campaign will figure out a way to get its money up through whatever backroom shady deals or whoever's paying for what, financial campaign regulation the campaign rule that they might just sort of violate, doesn't matter. I get this feeling that, you know, Donald Trump is going to wriggle his way out of another problem. So I think that needs to be prepared for, that yes, the Biden campaign has the money advantage now, and that's good. Whenever you have an advantage, it's definitely a benefit. But we cannot guarantee that Trump won't gain back that money. And a big question right now is Trump's plan to rival the Biden fundraiser that raised $26 million. Trump is planning on going to Georgia, and then I believe one other state, for two events that with big money donors that plan to rake in $33 million. This is the plan. This is what the Trump campaign has put out. This is what Republicans are broadcasting. Whether or not it actually comes to fruition is a different question. I'm not sold that Trump is going to get $33 million out of these events, because $26 million is a ton of money for an event that had a crazy number of stars like Lea Michele and Lizzo and Ben Platt, and Stephen Colbert was hosting it, or, you know, hosting a round table discussion with President Obama and Bill Clinton and Biden. Like, the fact that all of those people came together and raised $26 million is a really, really wild event. It's the largest fundraising event in history. And, of course, Trump hates that Biden raised more money than him ever in a presidential campaign, and he needs to win. I am not convinced that this will be the floodgates being let loose and Trump getting a lot more of the money that he is sort of clamoring for. I think a lot of big money donors don't want to give money to Trump so that he can just pay it on his legal bills, which makes sense. They want it to go towards his campaign. But Laura Trump, the co-chair or the co-COO or the co-chair, I don't remember which one, of the RNC, said that she will pay for Donald Trump's legal bills, that the RNC will bankroll Trump's legal bills. There was a motion put forward in the RNC roundtable meetings of the leadership to prevent RNC dollars for being spent on a campaign to go to Trump's legal expenses, and it was shot down. So Trump's legal expenses will be bankrolled by the RNC. And because of that, big money donors don't want to give money to someone to fend off legal battles, or at least not right now. Maybe when it's crunch time, they will. But that Biden's not going to have any shortage of money this cycle. And luckily for Democrats, neither will almost any House candidate and Democratic Senate candidate. Democrats are very, very well positioned financially, which is something you could not say about the Democratic Party 10 years ago, where they were floundering and didn't have any cash. And Republicans were the party of big money and big fundraisers. And the only prolific fundraiser was Obama, who got his money largely from small money donors. So it's unclear what the Trump's money situation will be, and I don't think that this event will receive $33 million. I don't know how much it will raise, but it's a sticky situation that I foresee him getting out of at some point in the future, especially after Labor Day, when the campaign really heats up. But what the Biden campaign can do with this money is obviously attack Trump, but shape how the public sees RFK Jr. Shape how they see him not as an environmentalist lawyer, not as a Democrat, but as a conspiracy theorist and as an anti-vaxxer. And if the Biden campaign does not do that and does not start now, because perception of candidates begins now, then they are making a grave error. So that was a big spiel on RFK Jr. And he's definitely going to be something that I'm going to bring back up in the future, because he's a wild card. And like I said, we don't know how his candidacy is going to play out because we don't know how the campaigns are going to handle him. But there's been some other stuff going on in elections and in trying to read the tea leaves of how November will play out. And the most recent one that many major news networks picked up on, and even the Biden administration spoke out about, was a special election in Alabama's 10th state Senate district. I believe it was a state Senate district. It was a state House seat. This was in State House District 10. And the special election was, there was a Republican who vacated the seat, resigned, and so that triggered a special election to occur, with one Democrat facing one Republican after whatever primaries shook out. And this district was one that the Democratic candidate blew out of the water in terms of election performance. This is a district that is Trump plus one, so it's shifting blue, so it's a Republican sort of tilting district, but it's moving more and more towards the left. And Alabama, in the past month, the Alabama Supreme Court struck down in vitro fertilization, something which I mentioned earlier on the show. Nicole Shanahan, RFK Jr.'s VP, said was a lie that should stop being done, essentially, that IVF should be ruled as unconstitutional. So RFK Jr.'s VP nominee has a lot in common with the Alabama State Supreme Court. And so the Supreme Court struck down IVF, and this really mobilized voters on the issue. It mobilized them so much that the Democrat in this Trump plus one district ended up winning by 25 points. That's outperforming Trump's margin in the district by 26 points, which is insane. It was Marilyn Lance. She was a Democrat, and she ran specifically on reproductive rights, abortion, but also IVF, because it was so pertinent to the state's politics. And this was last Tuesday. This was a week from today. Her performance was so good that she actually outperformed the last person to win, the last Democrat to win Alabama statewide, which was Doug Jones in 2017, who won a special Senate election to hold the seat for 3 years. It was an unbelievable result for Democrats, winning a Democratic seat in Alabama. The last time that had been done was an Alabama seat had been held by a Democrat was, I believe, Richard Shelby, who was a Democrat who became a Republican after I think it was in 80s or the 90s, something like that. And so Leeds, the Democratic candidate for this House district, outperformed Jones's margin by about 2%, which is an unbelievable overperformance. And so many were quick to say abortion, IVF are the issues to run on, and that this is a harbinger of what is to come in November for the Biden campaign and for Democrats, that they're going to sweep and they're going to perform extraordinarily well. Now, there's nothing that might be the case. Democrats might have a really, really good wave performance and smash the election, you know, out and really, really win. Voters, independents, Republicans, and the Biden campaign could be reelected with an overwhelming majority, and it's very possible Democrats could keep the Senate, even though it's unlikely, and retake the House. But the reality of the situation is that this election result is not good to be used to extrapolate to the country as a whole. The reason why is because it's not replicable on a national scale. Yes, the Supreme Court struck down abortion, and abortion is definitely on the ballot. In terms of IVF, that's not something they're going to do, and therefore it's not really relevant in the minds of voters when they're going to be going to the polls in November. Trump is also supportive of IVF because I guess he doesn't really have a campaign death wish. And Republicans in the Senate have refused to pass a bill that enshrines IVF, as much as they want to support, and as much as the Republican National Senatorial Committee wants to tell their candidates to support IVF. The Republican senators sitting have blocked the IVF bill, Senator Tammy Duckworth from Illinois, her bill to enshrine IVF access as a piece of law, that IVF access nationally cannot be infringed upon. That is a constitutional right in that sense. And it was the Mississippi Senator, Nicole Hyde Smith, who blocked it, and other Republicans who joined her in blocking it. So as much as Republicans want to say that they are supportive of IVF and that they do not agree with the Alabama Supreme Court's decision, it's not true. Again, watch what they do, not what they say. What they do is not vote into law a bill that protects IVF access. And it's not the issue with this is that it's not a worry in the minds of voters actively, because there's been no change essentially. Many, many Republican states will not be transgressing the rights of in vitro fertilization, and that even though Republican senators are blocking it, because people aren't feeling the effects of it, and because it's basically a statewide issue for which most states agree that IVF should be allowed, people are not feeling the effects. And while it might be a risk that they could take with a Trump presidency or an extremist Republican majorities in any state or in the House or in the Senate, it's not pertinent to this campaign in a specific way, because it's not threatening actively to anyone in a specific way. This election result's also going to be the case where you have a turnout that is naturally going to be higher amongst Democrats and college-educated voters, and not for the rural, non-college-educated voters. Though it's a great performance for Democrats, and definitely one that should be sort of factored into how we see the overall environment in terms of looking at special elections in an aggregate, which is a tool that many use to predict election environments in November. It doesn't really extrapolate well to saying that a Democrat won in a local district with a really local issue that was going on, and so that's going to be the case for Biden in November. Chalk it up as a victory, but it's not anything more than what the result is, which is just a flipped seat for the Democrats. From a ruling yesterday in Florida, so we're moving from Alabama to Florida, the Florida Supreme Court approved two ballot measures where for legalizing recreational marijuana and enshrining access to abortion in the Constitution, in the state Constitution. At the same time, in that same ruling, they also upheld a six-week abortion ban in the state. So Florida is currently under a six-week abortion ban. And many voters and many people that I've seen on Twitter, many talking heads say, this is a big news for Florida. The fact that both of these things will be on the ballot with Biden is a really big deal because it'll help turn out Democrats and get Democrats on the side of and get the state delivered for Biden. And then the election will really be over, because if Biden wins Florida, he'll win the presidency. The reality of this situation is that, again, it's one of these things that seems like it'll help Democrats, but it doesn't really. It's one of these tea leaves that, again, you try to read as, will this be good for Biden in this state? But it doesn't really make a change. It doesn't really make a difference. While these are both really good ballot amendments that should be up for election and that the Florida voters will likely agree to, Republicans, independents, and Democrats alike will vote for abortion access, will vote for legalizing recreational marijuana. What they won't all vote for is Joe Biden. Because in 2020, we saw a very similar result, which I saw from someone on Twitter who had mentioned that in 2020, the Florida state legislature put up a ballot amendment for raising the minimum wage, I believe, to $15. That was at the same time that Joe Biden was on the ballot. And that ballot amendment passed by 20 points, and Trump won the state by 3, which is a differential of 23 points between the two. And with this, with the ballot measures to legalize recreational marijuana and to enshrine abortion access, the Biden campaign has said Florida's in play. We're going to really make an effort for Florida. This is not a good decision. I think the Biden campaign has a lot of good people on it, and it's very possible that this could really just be signaling to voters that, like, look, we're not going to give up on anyone, and we want all voters to feel represented. And if they have enough money and they've spent all of their money in every media market that they can, and they want to throw a few million dollars into Florida, by all means, once they have invested in the proper swing states. But the reality of the situation is that from 2016 to 2020, Trump improved his margin in Florida. He improved it by 1.5% because Trump won the state by about 1.5 points in 2016. He then won the state by, I think, 3.5 points. So he improved his margin of 2% while the national environment shifted to the left, because from 2016 was a national popular vote of 2%. And in 2020, the national popular vote was 4.5%. So adding those up, that means that Trump improved on his margin by like 4 or 5% in Florida, which is crazy because Florida was a swing state in 2016 as well. And 2020, suddenly it was not a swing state. It's a very close margin, but it's not a margin that reminds you of something like Wisconsin being 0.7% or Georgia being decided by 0.2%. I think everyone forgets that Georgia was decided by like 10,000 votes. Florida was decided by a couple hundred thousand for Trump. Not only that, while the polls are funky and I don't necessarily believe them all, the primaries for states that have happened with the Democratic primaries for Biden for the presidential nomination in states that have big Latino and Hispanic populations have registered major disapproval for Biden in terms of defection. While we haven't seen this in majority black areas, and we haven't seen this in white voters, we've seen a registered disapproval of Biden amongst Latino and Hispanic voters, that they have been active in not voting for Biden. They've gone to the polls and made a decision overtly to not cast a ballot for Biden. And so I don't even know if Florida's majority white. I think Florida's majority is majority Hispanic, or at least plurality Hispanic. Okay, so that was I don't believe correct, non-Hispanic white people, white voters are, or non-Hispanic white population is larger than the Hispanic population in Florida. But the fact that this state has more Latino and Hispanic voters than any other state, and they have registered both in polling and in the primary in the ballot box that they do not approve of Biden and they will not be voting for him again, is indicative that Florida won't get any closer. It doesn't matter that Biden will make inroads in the many suburbs, because it's going to be an outsized growth for Trump and for the Republican Party with Latino and Hispanic voters. So the Biden campaign to state that they're going to invest in Florida and that Florida is up for grabs is fine if they're putting some money in the ad markets, if they've spent all their money everywhere else. If they can't spend any more in Michigan, Wisconsin, Pennsylvania, Nevada, Arizona, and Georgia, then by all means, go ahead and spend some money in Florida, and North Carolina, because that's the next state that's up. But the Biden campaign has also made a great number of good decisions. I'd say overall the Biden campaign knows what they're doing. And that is recently opening up a ton of field offices, none of which are in Florida, thankfully. But the Biden campaign just announced 44 field office openings in Wisconsin, 30 in Michigan, and 10 in North Carolina. And a field office, what it essentially means is that it's a location where the campaign is putting in a lot of effort, a lot of time. They're going to have full-time staff hired there, and they're taking it seriously. The Trump campaign, on the other hand, has opened up zero field offices in any state. Field offices for Trump in 2020 were plentiful, and the Biden campaign is starting early, which is a really, really good sign. And getting back to the point of abortion, in terms of, so the fact that you have the field offices in these states and that Florida should not sort of have field offices, really shouldn't be invested in. And this abortion measure is also going to be on the ballot in a few other key states. These states, it'll actually be helpful for the Democrats, because in these states, there is a Democratic base that is really not shrinking. In Florida, Democrats keep hemorrhaging voters and hemorrhaging support. But abortion's on the ballot in Nevada and Arizona and Montana. All of these have key Senate races as well. So while many voters in these states might not want to turn out for Biden, they'll turn out for an abortion amendment. And then while they're there, maybe they'll vote for Biden, but they'll definitely be voting for the Democratic Senate candidates. And Montana is a state where they need every Democrat they can to come out of the woodwork to support John Tester. And in Nevada, same goes for Jackie Rosen. And in Arizona, same goes for Ruben Gallego, just announced that he raised $7.6 million this quarter, which is an obscene amount of money for a Senate race. The last time I heard that kind of money was like quarter two, so the next quarter of an election year, and it was Mark Kelly in Arizona, who must have raised like $11 million. So Arizona Democratic Senate candidates know how to raise money. But getting back to the point, the fact that abortion is going to be on the ballot in these three states, and the reason why it's different between these three states and Florida, is because Florida has consistently been losing Democratic support. Democrats are moving away from, or I guess voters, I guess I should say, in Florida have been moving away from the Democratic Party. And in Montana, it's sort of stagnant. In Nevada, again, moving a little bit away from the Democratic Party, but not in a crazy amount. And if they are moving away from the Democratic Party, they're really just becoming independents. And in Arizona, there's movement towards the Democratic Party. So there's also a different electorate in these states. These states are just fundamentally different than those than the voting electorate in Florida. So the fact that abortion is on the ballot in Nevada and in Montana and in Arizona is going to be helpful for these Senate candidates to hold on to the majority of the Democratic majority, and it's going to help bring Democrats out. And if it helps bring Democrats out to vote for that, maybe it'll help them vote for Biden and vote for the Senate candidates. What I'll say is that this election season is far from over. Think about it as a toss-up. I'm going to keep analyzing these little tidbits of news that come in. The RFK Jr. bit is definitely the largest undertaking that needs to be sort of held to the greatest scrutiny in terms of how the campaign is operating, what his favorables look like, and how his polls are sitting him over the next few months. And the Biden campaign has a duty to do a very, very strong ad push against RFK Jr.'s candidacy and painting him in the likes of another Donald Trump. So that's going to do it for me here today. I will be back next week. I will definitely be back next week to discuss some other fun things that have happened in electoralism and what matters for the 2024 presidential election and all the elections underneath. This has been Swing Politics with Big Mitch Saunders, and you're listening to 91.5 FM WMFO Medford Tufts Freeform Radio. Thanks so much for listening in, and I'll see you all tomorrow, or see you all next week. Bye, everyone.
I'd like to think it makes me proud, but I'm only fooling me. I know she'll be looking back the minute I'm not there, while she pours herself on some stranger, I poured myself a drink somewhere. She's acting single, I'm drinking doubles. I hide my pain, I drown my troubles. My heart is breaking like the tiny bubbles. She's acting single, drinking doubles. I know what she plans to do, but I don't know where or when. If I ask who that stranger was, she'll just say an old friend. I'm not weak, I tell myself, I stay because I'm strong. The truth is I'm not man enough to stop her from doing me wrong.